You are listening to FMA Talk Live. FMA Talk Live is a live talk show created for the promotion of Filipino martial arts. Your hosts are John Binarski, Federico Malabago, Mark Basil, and Datu Tim Harmon. For more information on the show, upcoming events and guests, information about the hosts, their schools, and more can be found at www.fmatalklive.com. Also check out www.fmatalk.com for general FMA news, events, and discussions. On Facebook, we're at facebook.com/FMA Talk Live, and we're FMA Talk Live on Twitter. If you're listening on iTunes, please subscribe to our channel and give us a great rating. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, we're live. This is FMA Talk Live. Thanks again for tuning in and checking out some FMA talk here. We are excited to once again continue on with our series of Tambuli Media. We'll get to that in a bit, but first, check us out at fmatalklive.com. We have a lot of information there for upcoming shows. All our past shows are there as well. We have streaming media if you're interested in checking out all of the conversations we've had with other grandmasters through the years and just general talk here and there. And then also go to our Facebook page and like it, please. Tell your friends. We encourage everybody to tune in and try and spread the art however we can, and this is one of the ways to do it.
Definitely on the Facebook aspect, we've looked at the stats, and the number one way people know about the show is through Facebook. And so, you might think when you click like, I'm just clicking like to another random Facebook thing, but it really does help us out. We've been amazed at how much word of mouth has been able to spread this podcast about, and as we've said in other podcasts, this is an archive of various masters, grandmasters, practitioners in their own voice. And that's something, that we're hoping, 10 years down the road, 20, 30, 100, that practitioners can go back and listen to the grandmasters speak for themselves and tell their own stories for themselves, or in this case, the students of the grandmasters. It's an important activity, and the more people know about it, the more willing others are to participate, because naturally, if you're asked to participate on a random podcast, you might be a little bit more hesitant versus a podcast that all your students are telling you.
We are the number one FMA podcast.
We are the only FMA podcast.
On iTunes and Stitcher. So, let's not discount ourselves here. We're, as far as random podcasts, we're number one. If you're looking for some interesting FMA weapons, we do from time to time carry some items that we find from here and there in our travels. We have a few things still left. We have one of our immense giant bally swords. So, if you need to do the one-upsmanship over somebody who has a 29 or something like that, and you just can't help yourself, we have a, what is that thing, about 48 inches long?
I think it was
about
39.
The size of a Buick.
if I remember right, it's 39 overall, and it's definitely one of those things, if Crocodile Dundee pulls out his little Bowie knife,
oh, yeah,
you can laugh.
this thing is ridiculously huge. And the cool thing about it, too, is it's made right in Balasong, and it's made with the same craftsmanship as the small blades. So, you're pulling out, a giant hunk of Kamagong, a giant hunk of steel. The thing must weigh like 15 pounds or something. It's an interesting piece. Anyway, so we have one of those left. We've sold a few of them. We have some of the Bahi left that we may or may not sell. We're still trying to debate on whether we want to get rid of it.
If someone twists our arm, we'll get rid of it, but we're not exactly advertising the sale.
Whether or not you're worthy to own it or not, yes.
I don't know if... Is there anything else left, or is that it? The Bahi and
we have some of some utility bolos. We're selling them fairly cheap, $35. And it's one of those things, They're uglier than sin, at least if you like Western shiny knives. But if you have an appreciation for rusty old blades, well, they're not rusty, but for those ugly blades, they're meant
machete,
to,
you
know, meant to work. You know, we still have a few of those, and they're great for practice.
And hearkening back to the tradition of Scrima, you know, back in the day, that's what you would practice with, right? So there you go. So, you know, it's like driving one of those old rat rods.
No,
you know,
exactly.
It's not
paying homage to tradition.
Yeah, it's not the shiny. It's not a shiny new Cadillac, but yet, you know, you're still. It's old school yet new school, so there you go.
And it'll definitely get the job done, and that's the beauty of these utility bolos, is that they're not made to hang on a wall or be used to swung in there. They're made to work, and they will work.
So also we have our Twitter feed, so FMA Talk Live on Twitter, so you can subscribe to that. Everything that goes up on the FMA Talk Live blog will be broadcast on our Facebook page and on our Twitter. So if you're looking for kind of what the latest upcoming show is, then just subscribe to that and you'll get it in your feed. Let's see. If you're looking for some interesting Escrima and or Indonesian arts and you just happen to be in the south side of Chicago, you can check out our co-host, John Benarski. Guru John is down in Midway Koden Kan, and you can also check out his Facebook page at Tatlu Pusaka Senjata. You can also look up Federico and myself, Mark Basil. We're at bahadzubu.org or vikingcombat.com. That's where you can find our meetup group if you want to check us out up here in Minnesota. If you're looking for either some guys to train with, some sparring partners, if you want to play a little bit, or if you want to learn Master Yuli Romo's art of Bahadzubu, we can try and show you what we know. So,
but definitely, you know, if you want to make a new friend and impress us, we love guys who come in and want to spar. They're few and far between, but you know, every time someone has, it's been a good time. And you know, and that's the thing. A lot of people look at sparring as this scary ego thing where everyone's, you know,
just you.
Bad blood.
No.
But, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. We definitely don't encourage, you know, bad energy in sparring. But, you know, it can be fun. And, you know, some of the best friends I've met, you know, before we've exchanged a few words, we've exchanged a few stick blows. So, you know, definitely, you know, if you play this art and you're having a hard time, like a lot of guys, to find a sparring partner, we're always welcome. You're always welcome at our place.
And so with that being said, we'd like to welcome a kindred spirit in the world of not only Escrima, but also realistic training. And it's great to have Guru David Gould on.
Yeah, we're style cousins.
Yeah.
You know, our teacher, GM Yuli, and his teacher, Punung Guru Edgar Saliti, were friends back home.
Exactly, yeah. That's Guru David, thanks for being on the show with us.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess, you know, we could probably start out with you know, one of the questions we were talking about before the show, which is, you know, what kind of drew you to Edgar Punung Guru Saliti and you know, the style of Lomeco?
Well, when I first met Edgar, I was basically just looking for training gear, and I noticed in, I think it was Black Belt or Inside Kung Fu, one of the magazines that he was advertising for the Dosipares headgear as well as some of the hand armor that he was making through Lomeco. So I just basically contacted him to get that. I wasn't really looking to, you know, to get into another system at that point in time. I was really happy training the Peggy Thursa system under Duan Leogati. And I contacted him and, you know, went and met him, picked up the gear, and he gave me a demonstration of the gear, and I mean, it just blew me away how smooth he was and how much power and how little he telegraphed. I mean, this guy was amazing. So once I saw that, you know, it kind of piqued my interest. Well, I wanted to see more. So he offered the opportunity for me to take a private lesson with him. I jumped at it. And when I went back for the first private with him, within 5 minutes, man, I found what I've been looking for all my life, and I've been with it ever since. That was October the 20th, 1992.
Beyond the fluidity of his movement, what was your first impressions of his teaching style?
He was a very humble guy and a person of very little words until he got to know you. He spoke 100% with his abilities, you know. Mm. He never really talked about anybody, much less say anything bad about anybody. He would, if you asked him about somebody, he would look at you and say, well, I think he moves okay, or I think his movement needs to be improved, or you know, I think he's a good fighter, or I think that there's still development that needs to be done. I mean, he wouldn't go in and say, well, this guy sucks, or he's no good, or you could beat him up, or whatever. He judged you not by your reputation, but by your movement. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that really struck me from the beginning, because, you know, especially in the West, there's a lot of ego, you know, to the Filipino martial art or any martial art, and he really cut through that, you know, and he spoke with his ability as opposed to his words, and that impressed me.
Awesome. And so what were those early days like in training? Was it a lot of basic repetition, or, you know, what was the first thing he wanted to teach you?
Edgar always, he taught to leave the impression that failure was a better teacher than success. So anyone can build a certain amount of confidence in their technique or their ability when they succeed all the time. But in a real situation, you're not going to succeed all the time. And if you only train to succeed but you never fail, what happens the first time that you have to deal with failure? You're not going to be able to turn that failure into success. So he would really impress himself on you. And if you tried to counter, he would block you and he would counter back just to see what your reaction was. Mm-hmm. He wanted you to be as close to reality as you possibly could be. So he would start slow and you would learn under his guidance, then he would start pushing the envelope, start resisting a little bit more, start coming back a little bit faster, a little bit harder to see what your reactions would be. And he was known for doing the unexpected attack. So he wasn't really too concerned with what you did when you expected something coming at you. He wanted you had to deal with something that you didn't expect.
Mm. And so this was the first time. Oops. Go ahead, John.
Oh, sorry. And did he is this something that he actually developed himself in coming up with Venego Escriba, or is this something that was actually taught to him by his teachers, the ones that actually gave him the base for the
He credited two of his teachers with this aspect of training. One was Grandmaster Caballero from the Dicampo Universo Tres Orinales system, and Grandmaster Papang Ilustrismo from the Caliph Ilustrismo system. And both of those were reactionary fighters, and they were very, very successful, you know, throughout their lives. Each one fought numerous duels, some to the death, some not to the death. One, Grandmaster Caballero, would only fight with sticks, even though he would fight against guys using a sword or a barao, whereas Papang, he would always use a sword.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, I remember a story about the Grandmaster speed and his power, where he would actually shatter a coconut and with a good old with a stick, and would actually break the shards as they were falling onto the ground. So, do you think is that where Edgar actually got his speed and power from in that regard, or was it actually a combination there of all the methods that were taught to him that gave him this ability?
Well, when he was training with Grandmaster Caballero, this was early in his development, and when he was training with him, he learned to strike in big circles, and he thought that was the best way, because with a stick, you need to build a certain amount of momentum. But having said that, he always said, Grandmaster Caballero did, that your second strike has to come back twice as quick as the first strike went out so that you could recover your center line once violated, because you were really relying that you had to strike with a lot of power, and not wide, a long center, but you would break the tip of the stick to the back of your body. So that was his method, and he felt that in doing that, he just needed to work on his recovery strikes to be able to come back to center quickly before his opponent had a chance to counter. But when he started working with the Fong, he saw something totally different. Even though the systems were very similar, one was with the pinuti, the sword, where you're striking very small. The Fong called this walang bonot, which means not to allow the tip to go behind you. Whereas Grandmaster Caballero, that was his mandate, was to throw the tip behind you so that you could use the momentum. So you need it with the stick, but you don't need it with the blade. So it came from those two teachers, and he struck a fine balance. Whenever he would fight with the sword, he would adhere to the principles of the Ilustrissimo system, and when he struck with a stick, it was always with Caballero.
Huh. You know, that reminds me of when we were with Master Yuli one afternoon, and he was kind of showing us some differences between styles, and he was kind of explaining or showing us how Yuli or how Tatang would spin his sword, and he would say, "Okay, this style would be, you know, he'd kind of fan the blade in a big circle, and then he'd say, now this is how Tatang would do it, and it would be this really tight inside circle right in front of him, kind of right, you know, pointing right at the guy's head."
He was amazing. I had the chance to meet Tatang twice. I met him once, and I got to actually train with him a little bit one time. Punaguru had set up a meeting when I was going back to the Philippines to train with Duongati. In 96, he sent some headgear and some other training equipment for me to get to Tatang. So I was able to meet Good Master Tony Diego and Tatang and actually, you know, exchange energy with Tatang, and it was just absolutely amazing. So everything that Punaguru had told me about him whenever I was training with Punaguru, you know, I was able to actually experience live, and his ability to find the opening was just uncanny. I mean, you would expect a volley of techniques to happen before you would be struck, and before you realize it, he had already found three or four openings in you. And it was based on reaction. It had nothing to do with a trained reaction. It was a reaction that he developed. He saw the opening. He found the most direct route to that opening. I mean, the guy was amazing.
What was that? So I've always wondered that. So when you were, you know, going to exchange or to throw a blow, he would just use that traction to get in and then get out before you could even, you know, get your shot off?
It depends on how you were actually delivering the strike. With Tatang, you could feed him the same strike 10 times and you would get 10 different reactions. So he would say, this one you're late, this one you're on time, this one you're early, this one you telegraphed, this one you waited too long, you hesitated. And he would always give a different response because he saw a different weakness each time that you threw that same strike.
Yeah. Wow.
And so you felt Punaguru Suliti, he could recreate a lot of that same ability when he was training you guys here in the U.S.?
I thought he was awesome. He thought that he didn't compare to Tatang at all. You know? So, I mean,
wow.
That's very typical. But I was very impressed when I met Tatang, and I had trained with Punaguru Suliti for 4 years before I actually had a chance to meet Tatang and train with him. And he lived up, in the short amount of time that I actually got to exchange energy with him, he lived up to everything and then some that I was anticipating or expecting to get from him. The knowledge that he has and just his view on combat was very unique, based 100% on experience. And that's unusual. You know, usually coming from the West, you don't get that kind of experience.
Mm. And what would you say, at least, you know, were the differences between training, or let's say between Punaguru Suliti's take on Kali's Ilustrissimo versus when you actually met Tatang?
What Edgar tried to do was he would try to add his own personal experience to the techniques, to the reactions that Tatang would basically teach them. As you know, whenever the five pillars were kind of diagnosing and digesting the system from Tatang, it wasn't in a clear order like a curriculum that you would have in a standard issue system today, that they would feed Tatang and he would react and they would record the reaction. So one of them would basically feed Tatang and they would watch what he did, and the other four pillars would sit on the ground and they would write what he did, and they're the ones that actually came up with the names to the majority of the stuff. Some names that were in Spanish that he would give them, but a lot of the stuff he didn't have names for. It was the four pillars, mainly Crispo Ricketts and Punaguru Suliti and Master Yuli and Tony Diego that had to put names to these.
Mm.
Interesting. So what were the actual major, then, as we're talking about this, the actual major influences on Punaguru, Edgar Suliti, Lamento, Escrima? Just in case nobody knows, you know, what these are.
Okay,
yes.
he kind of divided these into two areas. One were people that he had formal training under, that he actually trained in depth with, and he was certified to teach their individual systems. And then the other ones were people that he would kind of get introduced to, would train with a little bit, but he didn't formally train under them. So he had five major influences, which, not in any particular order, but Cali Lefrismo, Cali Pecritersen, Modernos Largos, and Solita Rapilon, which was his family system. Those were the five majors. The six minor influences were Doce Pares, Valentawak, La Ponte Araniste Abanico, Siete Teros Cerrado, Cerrado No Puede Entrar, and Abanico de Sunquiti, and Tres Personas de Escrima de Combate, from Major Timoteo Maranga. So there were about 11 systems mixed between major and minors that he credited with the development and the creation of LAMICO.
Okay, so some of these systems then actually gave, as the major systems actually gave technique then, and some of the minor systems you would say then gave principles to the LAMICO Escrima system then, you said?
Principles, technique, concepts, energy, like a couple of the uncredited systems. One was the Motomoto system from Master Andrew Abrian, which he got a lot of the, like the sarong technique, a lot of the bandana, and the cimarron style from Grandmaster Abdul Haikahar, Madueno, which is from Mindanao, and it's kind of a moto system. So he really was able to get certain things from each one of the systems, whether it be a technique or a principle or a concept or an ideology. I mean, there was always something he found of value, and he would add that into his LAMICO.
Awesome. One of the systems, you know, if you would mind talking a little bit about, I'd love to hear more about his father's system, the Suliti Rapilon system.
Right. It's kind of an interesting story that his first introduction, obviously, since it's the family system, was through this system, and it was when his father and his grandfather were training. He was only about 4 years old at this time when they were still living before they moved to Mindanao. Clacking of sticks going on in the back of the house, and he was curious. You know, four-year-old kid. He walked back, and he saw his grandfather and his father basically hitting each other with sticks, and he couldn't understand, you know, what was going on between them that would make them fight with sticks. And they had to calm him down because he thought they were really fighting and they were mad at each other and were trying to kill each other. So that was his first introduction to Escrima at, you know, at any rate. So whenever he started training, about 6 months, 7 months after that, his father started teaching him the Solite Rapilon system. So his father learned from his father and his uncle. His uncle was the one that actually developed the system. And that was the first thing that Punaguru Soliti had trained in. And then when he moved to Osame City in Mindanao, then he started training with Grandmaster Caballero and Tuhongahi. But the Soliti Rapilon system, there's a little bit of the Ilustrismo system influence in it, because the father of Punaguru Soliti, he trained under one of the uncles, Malicio Ilustrismo of Tapang. Difference between the Cali Ilustrismo system when Malicio had it and how it developed under the Tapang.
Mm. And so was the Soliti's Cebuano then?
Man, you could consider it. He would just call it Waray.
Oh,
is
okay.
The local area where he's from in Tacloban. So
yeah, no, I'm Waray myself, so family's from Paulo.
Go.
So, but there, that's why I was kind of curious, because there's Cebuanos and Waray in that area, so I didn't know which side he fell on.
The Waray.
Oh, wow. So how did he ever say how his great-grandfather met Malicio Ilustrismo then?
He didn't really say. He just said that he was one of the major influences on his grandfather when his grandfather was putting the system together. And one of the major techniques and principles and concepts that he passed on to his father. And obviously, it kind of looked a little bit different with Tapang, but it had the same energy and it had the same intent. But Tapang had refined it down to where, I mean, it was so much in essence of what he did that was one of the cornerstones of the system for Tapang, when he would utilize, you know, his he would call it una pulgada, just stay just outside of the distance. And once the attack would come at him, he would cut it off or intercept or cut directly, but he would always find the opening very quickly. But Paracion is one of the things that he really relied on a lot.
For me, I was really curious that, you know, Fikiti Tersho then is one of the major influences on Lameco. What did Kunlun Guru actually get from Hmong Leo and Hmong Nene in that regard?
He trained more with Stuvan Leo, but he also trained with Hmong Nene, and he always helped me with his knife work. He was very impressed with the knife work that Grandmaster Nene would utilize. And from Tuon Leo, it was everything from just how to organize the system to how to teach it, how to deal with the nuances of developing a system and promoting it. And those are the things that he really got from Tuon Leo, as well as a lot of the footwork and stuff. The footwork was very important in Fikiti Tersho. And one thing with Tuon Leo, anyone that's ever trained with him, they know that he has high expectations and he will get you up extremely early in the morning and have you do footwork all day if necessary without, you know, giving you much of a break until you had it right. So footwork was something that was something very important to Tuon Leo, which means it became something very important to Edgar as well.
Interesting. So now let's talk about maybe some of the training progressions then in Lameco. So in regards to it, is it primarily done as a fighting method then, or is it done as a overall training methodology? I know that you have several phases. Maybe you would like to cover, you know, how the student actually progresses within the system.
In the beginning, like any other system, you have to learn the techniques, the drills, the concepts, the principles. But once you actually learn these things, then you have to evolve beyond the drills, beyond the disarms, beyond, you know, the concepts and the principles, and you have to start applying them in real time. Mm-hmm. So what Pono Guru would do is he would enter you into the training phase. So there's four phases of Lameco. There's learning, training, fighting, and teaching if you intend to teach one day. If not, then you just basically develop and refine in the fighting area. So once you, if you compare FMA to boxing, so to give you an idea of what I'm talking about, when a boxer starts learning his craft, he learns the jab and the cross and the uppercut and the hooks and the upper body work, and he learns how to defend himself, and he learns the distance and all of these critical things. That's the learning phase. Once he finishes or instills the basic foundation into his ability from the learning phase, then he starts training. By training, he doesn't relearn what he learned to begin with. He evolves it. So he starts getting in the ring, even though he's got headgear on and, you know, he's got heavy gloves and stuff like that to protect from cuts, but he still exchanges live energy with a non-cooperative opponent. So you start doing your sparring to kind of get the rhythm and figuring out the timing of your opponent. But it's not fighting because you're protected, okay? Once you get out of the training phase, then you go to the fighting phase, which means the gloves, you know, get a lot lighter to where they do a lot more damaging. The headgear comes off. You're susceptible to cuts. You have to go to 10 rounds or 12 rounds or whatever the fight is you're fighting. So that's how Pono Guru would teach Lameco. First you learn, then you train, then you fight. And then you spend the rest of your life refining your craft to where it's more efficient by doing less. Basically, that's one of the things that Pono Guru would say is that less is more. So the less that you violate your center line, then the less you have to move to recover. The more you violate center line, the more you have to move to recover. So you have to find that perfect balance between where you need to be to initiate with power, with precision and speed and timing, but not to the point where you're telegraphing your intent or you're wasting movement. So there was a lot of removing gap in the process. Gap is anything that's wasted, anything that actually adds to the timeline of what you're doing. To give you an idea of what I'm talking about, let's discuss timing. So at the point of violation is the perfect time to counter your opponent. If you allow him 3 or 4 seconds past the line of violation, he's already coming back to close center before you're able to counter what he does. So the closer to the point of violation that you're able to counter, then the higher your chances are of succeeding. So those were the things that he would refine in us through actual fighting at close to real-time speed or real-time speed against a non-cooperative opponent.
And was this done mostly through sparring, and was he very hands-on in sparring?
Sparring and and fighting. I was one of the members of the backyard group, and Ponoguru, even though I was a private student, I was also a member of his private backyard group, which was invitation only. There were 25 of us, and all of Lamiko that was part of this group at his house. And one of the reasons he developed this group was he wanted a link back to the Philippines. So there's a slightly less in how you train in the Philippines. I mean, there are exceptions, but for the most part, there is a difference. So he wanted to form a group to where he could link himself back to his days in the Philippines, and he also had hopes of, you know, because we had a lot of visitors coming from all around the world to the backyard, and we had to perform for them, and we had to make sure that, you know, we moved well and that we could fight, because we didn't want to embarrass Ponoguru whenever his teachers would come or his brothers would come and watch his students. So one of the reasons he developed the group as well was to kind of protect the legacy. So we ended up having to fight several challenges because there were people that would, I don't know why, but they would try to use his reputation to better themselves by, that if they could beat him, then they could use his reputation to kind of lift their own. So he did fly several people back to California that we had to fight, and we had to go to different cities to fight people as well for the same reason. So it was for sparring and it was for fighting.
So I just want to jump in here quick. Just take a quick break to say that in case you're joining late, we're talking to Guru David Gould. He's the author of the latest Timbuli media release, Lameco Eskrima, The Legacy of Edgar Sulite. And he's just kind of regaling us some of the tales of his training with Ponoguru Edgar Sulite, and also kind of the life and life and times of the man himself. You know, just again, thanks for being on with us, and for kind of, you know, we've enjoyed all of the releases from Timbuli Media so far, and you know, we've read the books, and we've read your book, and certainly hasn't disappointed. There's some awesome stories in there, and you know, one of the questions we did have is some of these, you know, some of the stories. You know, what I guess one of the questions I have anyway is, when you hear some of these stories, does your jaw just drop sometimes from some of the stories that you heard from Ponoguru when he told you some of the old time days?
Yeah, some were really just absolutely hilarious, because you have to imagine him, you know, and like I said, he was a very humble guy, very quiet, sincere guy, and to see him in some of these circumstances, I mean, it would bring humor to you. But he, once he got, he would share anything that he had to share with you. It's just a matter of him seeing that you're loyal and you're dedicated to him. You know, which is typical in the Philippines. You have to earn that respect and that relationship with your instructor. In the West, it's not so much that way, but in the Philippines, and I've spent quite a bit of time in the Philippines training with different people, that's what I've always found. But a lot of the stories that I shared in the book were interesting, but there's so many more. Mm-hmm. So many more.
And it seems that Edgar was also, always trying to improve upon Lameco. Could you talk about the times where you guys were also training with martial arts luminary Larry Hartzell and the development of, you know, possibly the knife grappling method within Lameco time period?
Yeah. Sifu Larry, he started in the system. And he was training privately at his home. Ponoguru would go over there, and he would train him there. He would train him at the Inosano Academy with Guru Dan, or at Guru Dan's house. And he was always trying to evolve the system. And since the BJJ thing came up, he saw a need for a ground defense, you know, for somebody that's trying to take you to the ground. But it wasn't so much from the aspect of trying to go into joint life and stuff like that as it was taking somebody to the ground, deploying a knife or picking up a rock or a brick and using an equalizer to defend a situation on the ground. So he asked me if I would like to go and assist him with Super Larry Hartzell's private classes in LaMico, and then after we would learn the JKD grappling from Super Hartzell, and then he would analyze the material and see if any of it could be translated to the knife, and if there's value there, then he if not, then he would look for something else. So we did that from 1994 until Punaguru Solite died in 1997. And some of that stuff was just, I mean, it was unreal how his mind worked, that he would see something that you wouldn't see for 100 years, and he would twist it around to this marvelous technique or concept or principle that he could utilize on the ground. And I was always impressed with this guy, but at the same time, I was extremely impressed with Super Larry Hartzell as well. That I had trained with him when I was at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I was a paratrooper in the military. And on weekends when we were actually in country, I would drive to Charlotte. I was in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Charlotte wasn't that far away. And I would go and I would train with Super Larry and sometimes with Dickie Harrell, which was one of his number one guys there at that time. And I trained with him off and on until 1986, give or take, and didn't really see him anymore until he moved to California. So see him because he had always intrigued me as well, you know, with his experience being one of Bruce Lee's, one of his fighters, basically, from the Chinatown School in Los Angeles. But Larry, he really, really came to love both Punaguru Solite and LaMico, and one of his favorite things to train was always the knife and then the double stick. I mean, those were the things that he really, really got off on the most in training LaMico. But to be able to be with both of them for so long and for 3 or 4 hours every time we go over to Super Larry's house, I mean, it's just, it's something that, you know, I couldn't hope for. I mean, that was like one of my wildest dreams to be a part of that.
And, you know, now going kind of full circle, can we also talk about like several of the concepts within the Minko, such as opportunity and other things that, you know, really make, you know, LaMico stand out in that regard? We'll circle to where we actually started, but I'd like to bring it to that, just for the folks at home listening.
To opportunity, meaning?
Meaning, you inspiring, you know, when do you press your opportunity? When do you seek your opportunity, or when do you acquire it?
When it came to sparring, he was trying to develop you, obviously, to your strengths. He would always tell us to play to our strengths, never to our weaknesses. But on the other side of the equation, to play to your opponent's weakness, but never his strength. So we were always looking for you know, that refinement process to be a little bit less telegraphic, to be able to counter at the precise time of violation, or to constantly work your position. That position was something that was very important to Punaguru, especially when you sparred. So he felt that if you had proper position, that footwork was kind of obsolete if you could maintain your line of engagement. The line of engagement is the line that invisibly separates you to where you're just outside of the range of your opponent. So if he just misses you, have access to be able to inch forward and hit him before he's able to come back to close the center line. So he used to say that it doesn't matter if he misses you by an inch or a mile unless you're going to counter. If he misses you by an inch or a mile and you just don't want to get hit, it doesn't matter. But if you intend to counter him and you miss by a mile, you have a whole lot of wasted space to go just to get to nothing, which means that by the time you get there, that opportunity is not going to be there anymore. So Papang had the same concept. He just called it una pulgada, which is an inch in Spanish, meaning that you just step back an inch from the range of your opponent so that you only have an inch to move forward to take advantage of the opening when it exists to you. So when we're sparring, it's close to real time or real time speed and power. And one thing that most people, they think of when there's opportunity is they kind of name it a window of opportunity, which is more like a door of opportunity if you're going. When you're really fighting fast, it's not a window of opportunity. It's the size of the crack at the bottom of the window. And you have so little time to be able to counter to your opponent. And if you're not used to that crack in the bottom of the window or that timeline, or an actual timeline, then you're going to have a hard time being able to counter your opponent. So the thing that was amazing about Punaguru is he was able to operate in that crack at the bottom of the window better than most people were able to operate in a door of opportunity. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was just so well-timed and well-positioned, and his speed was, I mean, it was off the record. That was one of the things that really impressed me with him, was his speed. And going back to something that you had mentioned before with Grandmaster Caballero, breaking the coconuts, that was one of the standard things that we did in the decompo training. So he would take a coconut and he would put it in a net bag and hang it from a tree, and you would break it. But with Ponoguro as well as Grandmaster Caballero, they could implode, and they would take the two biggest pieces and break those before all of it hit the ground. And I mean, their accuracy, their speed, their power was just unreal.
So what was that like when you first sparred with Punanguru, Edgar? Did you kind of realize that, whoa, this is something different than I've ever experienced before? You know, when did you kind of experience that traction and that timing firsthand?
I had always had an idea before I sparred him the first time, because you know, when you train with him, he always resists you. One of the things that I noticed from him from day one was that when you tried to stab him, you tried to hit him, he would deflect, or he would block, or he would move, or he would counter. And none of my other instructors had ever done that. They had always allowed me to touch them with my knife or to hit them, you know, even though it's with control, but they still allowed me to hit them. And I'm like, Ponoguro, why don't you let me stab you? And he said something that has stuck with me to this very day that made so much sense. He says, Dave, I train to live, not die. So if nice. I allow you to strike me and to stab me in training, he says, that's what I'm going to do on the street, because what I spend most of my time doing is the way that I'm going to react. So if I allow you to stab me all the time, then I'm not going to be able to flip a switch and say, okay, now you're not going to stab me, because you're going to react the way that you spend the majority of your time doing. So Ponoguro used to say that the for you to be effective, the very things that you train have to reflect the very things that you train as much as possible. So if there's all of this chaos and mayhem and uncertainty in the combative equation, which is the fight, then it has to be present in your training environment as well for you to be able to adapt and adjust to that.
What do you think influenced his perspective on training to live and not to die?
He had to live. Growing up, you're from there, and there were days when he was a small kid to where there were moto parties that would cruise up and down the rivers, and they would actually jump out of the boats and they would pull people out of their hooches and they would cut their heads off and just do a lot of bad stuff. So Ponoguro, he grew up in a very, how can you put it, a very dangerous environment. So one thing that he told me was, in before he had moved to Osame City in Mindanao, was that he had encountered a guy that was drinking tuba. His friend was drinking tuba as well, which is Filipino rice wine. And they were, you know, a little bit drunk. And Ponoguro's friend, he kind of looked crossway at the guy and he insulted him. So he embarrassed him. He, you know, when you have the eye contact, you someone's authority in the Philippines. So he looked too hard at him, and the guy wanted to kill him. So Ponoguro jumped in and says, hey, you know, you can't kill my friend. He's drunk. You know, if you want to kill him, wait until tomorrow so that you know what you're killing him for. And the guy says, nah, I'm going to kill him. So he pulled a machete. Ponoguro tried to disarm it, but he come down, and with the machete, he got Ponoguro from the top side of his stomach and cut back and disemboweled him. And Ponoguro reached down and picked up his intestines and still went for the guy, took the machete, and was able to stop the fight. But he almost died because
Holy
of the
crap.
Infection. And if you look at the photo on The Secrets of Our Niche, you can see a little bit of the scar at the top. But it was a huge scar on his stomach. And I didn't realize, you know, that he had it. And I didn't hear the story until about 3 years after I was training with him. And we had just finished sparring after a private class. And he came out of the shower, and I saw this huge scar. And I asked him about it, and he told me the story. And then I started seeing something from him that I didn't realize before, was that this guy wasn't teaching because it's something he enjoyed. He's teaching the Filipino martial arts because this is something that he needed to survive in the Philippines. Mm. Totally different perspective.
Wow. I mean, I don't know what exemplifies badassery more than holding your own intestines in while you take someone out.
He almost died. He caught
that
a bad infection. You know, out in the hinterlands, you don't have access to medical. You know, not like we have in the States.
Oh, sure.
So he got a bad infection, and for 2 or 3 weeks, he was close to death.
That is That is an amazing story.
He definitely is emblematic of the fierce spirit of that supposedly what I have. So that is beyond fierce at that point. That is amazing.
Once again, the book is Lameco Escrima, The Legacy of Edgar Salite. We're talking with Guru David Gould. He's once again regaling us. So that is an incredible story.
I believe it though.
Yeah,
remember the first time we landed in Tacloban. I have never seen so many severed arms.
Yeah,
guys with scars.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and they're out there working. You know, yeah. It's like, what do you do? Well, you know, you got drunk or whatever happened, and you know, we heard the stories from your aunt,
yeah,
or your cousin.
It's just
that's what happens. You know, that's how things are settled out there. Guru David, when we were reading your book, you know, both Federico and I have, you know, kind of wandered around. We've been to Leyte and Samar, and we've met a lot of the people who live there and whatnot. And we heard some stories, and you know, it was neat to read kind of, you know, the telling that you had of the wild nature of a lot of the people there and how they grow up. You know, a skirmish or a fight could happen at any moment. And, you know, we heard a lot of the same stories about, well, how do you, what are these Zanzibars for? Well, they're for fighting. So, and then we heard stories about, property disputes are being settled with these.
Fighting back in the day? No, fighting now.
Yeah, they're fighting now. It's like, well, guns are expensive, bolts are expensive, so how do you settle dispute? Well, if it escalates from a fist, or how do you stave somebody off when, you know, they're coming at you with a knife? Well, you grab your giant Zanzibar, and that's how things go down. So, it's crazy. So, yes, I totally believe that story. That's amazing.
One of the things that I asked him, when I started training with him, I had a perspective on the Filipino martial arts, which was quite different than his.
Mm.
And he was the first one to really show the reality of what was the Philippines and what it was like, you know, to get attacked, not by one person, but by five or six or seven people. So in the Philippines, you're not going to get attacked by one person, not unless he's christening his blade, because he's, you know what I'm saying?
Because you're going to get ambushed. People. Right, one guy's going to distract you while the other guy comes up on you.
Exactly. But I asked him, because he loved to train knife stuff, but he never carried a knife. And I asked him one day, I'm like, why don't you carry a knife? And he looked at me and says, because I would really kill somebody.
Nice. Another question I had for you regarding kind of those early years before Puranguru came to the U.S., as he was traveling around and kind of learning all these martial arts and everything, I don't know, maybe I just missed it in the book, but did he have a job, or what was his kind of occupation? You know, how was he earning any money as he was kind of learning all these arts and kind of bebopping around the Philippines, or the, you know, the southern half anyway?
Or at least before you met Alexander Cole.
Correct, yeah.
He didn't really have a job to speak of.
Okay.
He would do like odd things to make a little bit of money. And once he got with the he got him into security and stuff in Manila. And
so I'm sorry, just to interrupt you, quick, kind of cut out there. So before you met Tuhangahe?
Yeah, he was just doing odd jobs and stuff.
Okay. Yeah, I know, because he said he was had a tough time. You know, just even paying for, in the book, you're kind of talking about sometimes he would show up for Eskrima lessons and maybe had a couple bucks sometimes, you know, couldn't even pay and things like that, so.
Yeah, but he would also, after he started training Master Roland Dantes and got in contact with Christopher Ricketts' brother, Ronnie Ricketts, he started doing some acting, and it wasn't like in a major role. It was always the bad guy, and it was always like a movie. But he started in several movies in the Philippines as the bad guy, and he was also doing some commercials and stuff too.
Well, he had the scar, so that helps, right?
No makeup needed.
Yeah, a lot of shirtless photos.
No, but jumping topics a little bit, can you talk a little bit about his relationship with Grandmaster Roland Dantes? You know, another pillar or icon of FMA here.
He didn't want to sound like he was naive when he moved from the hinterlands, from Mindanao to Manila, but in reality he was, you know, it was a different world. And when he first got to Manila, he didn't really know a lot of the stuff that was going on. You know, like if you take him to a fine hotel, he had a hard time figuring things out, you know, because you do stuff different at your house in Mindanao, where you don't have electricity, that you would do in a nice fine restaurant that has all of these like running water and stuff like that. So it took him a while to kind of adjust to that, and the one guy, he really helped him with that. But he had never really seen a movie before until he got to Manila, and the first thing that he saw was, you know, one of Roland Dante's films. And he actually believed that Roland Dante's was doing this stuff that he saw in the movie. I mean, he was convinced that this guy had magical powers, you know, with his extrema, and he really wanted to follow up on this because he had never seen anything like this. You know, I mean, he came from the barrios, man. I mean, he was fighting for his life, and to see something like this, the skill was just off the record. So whenever he did have a chance to meet Roland Dante's, he went up and he was, you know, asking him about it, but Roland, he didn't really have a lot of time to talk to him, so he thought that he was more interested in weightlifting, you know, which that was primarily what Roland was into. And then the movie acting thing was kind of on the side. So whenever he did have a chance to talk to him, it was a very short conversation, and Roland told him, he says, hey, you know, if you want to learn more, you know, come by, you know, this place. He gave him the address to his gym, and he says, I have to go. So Edgar went to the gym to talk to him, and he thought they were there to talk about, you know, the martial arts, and Roland thought they were there to talk about weightlifting.
That's the best.
So Edgar's like, well, you know, can you give me any advice to help me, you know, be able to be like you? And Roland says, yeah. He says, just go over to the bench and, you know, start doing these curls. And Edgar looked at him like, what does this have to do with my esprima? So he goes over on the bench and he starts, you know, doing curls and stuff. And finally he asks Roland, he says, you know, this is great, but I don't see how this is going to help my esprima. And then that's the first time that Roland realized that he was there to talk to him about the martial arts and vice versa. Anyway, Roland wanted to see, because he was intrigued by Edgar coming from Mindanao, because, you know, he had spent a lot of time there himself, and he knew of a lot of the masters there. And he recognized a few of the people that Edgar said that he had trained with, so he was questioning him. And Edgar's like, well, you know, I'd be happy to demonstrate some of this for you if you want. And Roland's like, yeah, great. And he had two of the students in there. And so Edgar picked up a stick and he looked. He said, well, since there's three of you, I'll use two sticks. And immediately, you know, he told Roland and his two students to come at him. And he told him, he says, you can hit me anywhere that you want. I'll just hit you in the hands. And they attacked him, you know, sparring, but they came at him aggressively, and Edgar hit the hand of his two students, disarming them immediately, and then he did three quick strikes in front of Roland's face and just left it there. And oh, Roland was really impressed with Ponegoodle's speed and his power and his control. So that led to him starting a class at Roland's gym, and then Roland began training with him in the Lemico system.
So kind of jumping forward, we're getting up to the end of the hour here, so I want to make sure we talk, you know, a little bit about kind of you currently. You know, you're where's your role now in the Lemico system? And, you know, now that you know, obviously we've lost Punaguru Edgar, you know, these last few years, and, you know, things like that, where do you see the Lemico right now? Where do you fit in? How, you know, you're down in Mississippi now. Are you teaching a school? Do you have a, you know, kind of give us kind of an overview of that and whatnot? That'd be great.
I'm available for seminars, and I teach, have for some time now, a lot of our elite military and law enforcement in different countries around the world. And my Lemico brothers, I can't express, you know, their capability enough, that we're a family in every sense of the word. So it's not like one of us that's running the system. Leonard Trigg is the one that officially has the designation to control the system until Don Don Sulite, the oldest son of Ponoguro, gets out of the Navy, and he wants. We've been hoping that for a long time, but hopefully it'll happen soon. And for the most part, we as a family are still propagating the original Lemico that Ponoguro passed down to us. His original vision is very important to us. So we kind of made the decision early on not to prostitute the system out or to pimp it out, but to kind of keep it small and keep it pure, you know, so that it resembles exactly what it was when Ponoguro left it. And then whatever Don Don wants to do with it whenever he takes over the system is which direction it'll go. So I still teach seminars. I'm available for seminars. As are my Lemico Screamer brothers from the backyard in L.A. And for those that want to really understand more of the Lemico system, then either get in touch with myself or my Lemico brothers, and then you'll see, you know, basically what Ponoguru was trying to do with his Lemico. And again, it wasn't about passing on a system. It was more of a mindset. It was developing a fighter as opposed to teaching a system. And that's one of the things that Punogura would say. He would say that the backyard, that Amico Screamer was a combat system and his backyard was a fighting academy. And that's what he felt. And that's what we did. We spent more time fighting in the backyard than anything else.
Hmm. Oh, awesome. And, you know, in the book you mentioned, you know, that there's value, that Edgar's teaching was customized to each student. So would it behoove someone who wanted to learn Lameco and, you know, and get a good glimpse of Lameco to train with multiple students of Edgar?
Oh, absolutely. Edgar, he told me many times that in order to get a more clear image of him, you have to look at it like it's a jigsaw puzzle of 100 pieces, let's say, and each one of us was one of those pieces. So just like a jigsaw puzzle, if you only get one piece and you stick it in the center, you could look at it for 3,000 years. I mean, it wouldn't portray what it is that you're trying to portray. But if you put enough of the pieces together, then all of a sudden, you know, that image starts coming together. And we all carried a different piece of Punogura away. So he didn't teach the system one size fits all. He would look inside of you and see what your strengths were, and he would cater to your strength. He would enhance this. If there was a weakness, he would either remove it, diminish it, or replace it with something that was a strength. But it wasn't like he looked at everybody as though they were clones of himself. He didn't want 1,000 clones in his image. He wanted 1,000 warriors that were individually developed according to their own strengths, you know, diminishing the weaknesses that you would have. And he would tweak each one of us based on those strengths.
Okay, so as far as, you know, you writing the book, you know, what... you know, was there a certain, you know, trigger that kind of got you to write the book? Have you been developing this over years, you know, notes here and there, you know, collecting all this, thinking one day I'm going to write this book? Or
was it just all kind of for your personal sake, you know, I'm keeping these stories just to remember? And did you expect to write a book?
No, never. even to the time that I contacted Mark Wiley, I wasn't going to write a book. That I was a very studious student, which means that I took notes of everything that I did. Every class that I was with Punogura at Larry Hartzell's house at the Inosano Academy, every private class, every seminar, every camp, every backyard group class, I wrote down the notes, you know, because Punogura would critique things. So based on our sparring, he would say, okay, Dave, after the class, he would go over the things that he wanted to critique in the sparring, and I would write those things down, you know, to make sure that I had them, including the story. So if it was something that he was private about, he would say, oh, Dave, he says, this is, you know, this is just for you and your best students, which to him meant that you didn't share it. It was just things. But when I was taking the notes, I never dreamed of writing a book. You know, I always thought that he would be here when I was old. You know, I mean, that's what I was hoping for. I was looking forward to spending the rest of my life with him. And he had such knowledge that, you know, that was more than possible. Anyway, whenever I got in touch with Mark Wiley, I actually suggested that he write the book because, you know, I mean, he's a famous author. And I wanted this to ensure the legacy of Punogura and Lameco. So if Mark was to write the book, then I knew that would happen because people, you know, they would want to read it and they would be able to kind of keep Punogura where he belongs in the warrior art community, which is at the top. And he told me that he wasn't sure if he was the right person to write the book, you know, that he knew Punogura and he had trained with him a little, but he felt that it should be a perspective that was closer to Punogura that actually lived this, like myself and my Lameco brothers. So he asked if I would write it. Mm. And I told him that I'm not a writer. I fight. I'm not a writer, but I can put words together. And I asked my Lameco brothers what they thought about it, and I was able to get, you know, quite a few of them to kind of write a little thesis and a little chapter themselves, you know, to kind of reflect their experiences in the book as well, which to me makes the book really viable because you don't have just my perspective or my experience, you have their experiences as well.
Well, I can say for someone who says he's not a writer, you write very well, and we've been very, at least speaking for us here in Minnesota, we've enjoyed your book immensely. And
thank
it's
you.
Just a great glimpse into the life and the philosophy of Punogura Edgar Sliti. And, you know,
Well, you learn a lot. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You know, you hear about these, you know, the Pillars of Illustrissimo. You hear about, you know, these great, you know, fighters like, you know, Edgar Saliti. I mean, you don't travel in, you know, at least the circles that, you know, we travel. And the thing is that, you know, he touched so many systems that are huge. You know, you always hear that name. And to be able to dig deeper into that, you know, legacy and be able to, you know, kind of get the details of a lot of this.
Well, thank you for
putting those together.
He's revolutionized, you know, like how many people before Punongoro Edgar came around would spar like they spar now, you know?
Well, no, yeah.
You know, how many people would,
well, or be able
put
to teach
that emphasis on applicability and functionality in real time and not just in the learning stage?
Yeah, exactly. And be able to teach it. I mean, that's the thing, you know, Guru David, that's the one of the things that, you know, we find kind of rare is finding, you know, instructors that know how to teach that progression, you know, for developing fighters, you know, for whatever reason. But, you know, to be able to have, you know, that someone who was so good at it and had that lineage to be able to develop that, you know, it's great. And it's great to read about it. So, you know, the book has so many great stories. We just barely touched on it.
I'm glad that you guys like it. But one thing I would like to say is that LaMeiko wouldn't be LaMeiko without the influence of Christopher Ricketts as well. That his connection to LaMeiko and his connection to Punongoro's sparring partner was one of the things that made LaMeiko special, because of the thousands, you know, and I mean, say thousands of hours, I mean thousands of hours that they spent together sparring. Was absolutely critical in the evolution of LaMeiko. I couldn't imagine what LaMeiko would be without that influence and what they actually, together in sparring, found and were able to evolve the system together. Even though the Punongoro credited his masters with the knowledge for the system, that experience with Topper, Master Topper, Christopher Ricketts, and LaMeiko as Punongoro's sparring partner was absolutely critical.
All right. Well, again, you know, we're coming up to the end of the show, so we just want to say thank you for being on. And the book, once again, is LaMeiko Eskrima, The Legacy of Edgar Saliti, by author Guru David E. Gould. Is there anything you want to, or I'm sorry, is there a website or contact information? Obviously, you can buy the book on Amazon and from Tambuli Media.
You know, and we do have links to the Tambuli Media page for this book and Guru Gould as well.
But any plugs for your seminars? Any way, if anybody wants to bring you in, can they get in contact with you?
Yeah, so if they want to contact me, they can write me. My email is Guru Dave Gould, and it's at ATMT.net, and also on Facebook, Original Group, that they can look up and have to join as well.
I'm sorry, we cut out again. That's our wonderful gremlin. What was the Facebook again?
It's LaMeiko Eskrima Original Group.
Okay.
And they can just type that up and ask to join. And my email is GuruDaveGould@ATMT.net.
Perfect.
And before we go, and just to kind of wrap up the night, is there anything you would like to express to our audience about Punongoro Edgar Saliti or yourself? You know, just a final...
Words of wisdom.
Words of wisdom, yeah.
Yeah, Punongoro, he left us with quite a few videotapes. And to me, even though, you know, they're 20-something years old, they're probably some of the best on the system. So for anybody that wants to really see the LaMeiko Eskrima system, you know, from the hands of the founder himself, LaMeikoEskrima.com, which is Felisa Sulite, the widow of Punongoro, runs the site, and they also have a lot of good training gear and stuff on there if you want to add to your training, you know, to pick it up a notch and get a little bit more hard contact. So the hand armor and the headgear and the sticks and everything that they sell there is awesome, as well as the DVDs that Punongoro had.
Sounds good. All right, everybody. Well, once again, check us out at fmatalklive.com for all the updates. You can also check us out on Facebook, FMA Talk Live, and like us, please, and spread the word. Thank you very much, everybody who listens and who spreads the word. And also Twitter, hashtag FMA Talk Live. And once again, thank you, Guru Gould, for being on the show with us. And it was great talking to you. Hopefully we can have you back on in the future, if you'd be willing.
Yeah, that would be awesome. I enjoyed it.
Okay. In God, everybody. Thanks for listening.
In God.
Bye.
That was FMA Talk Live. For more information about this episode, past and future episodes, check out www.fmatalklive.com. On Facebook at facebook.com/FMA Talk Live. And we are FMA Talk Live on Twitter. Thanks again for listening.